is in the matter of State versus Steven Zadroga. May we please have appearances of counsel?
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Scott Welpel, Assistant Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of appellant Steven Zadroga.
Full name, Patrick N-J-R-I-T-I-M, on behalf of Campus D-C-E-L-N-J.
Good afternoon. Leonardo Rowley, Assistant Prosecutor, Hudson County Prosecutor's Office, on behalf of the state.
And I have Mr. Rinaldi arguing for the Hudson County Prosecutor. Is that correct? Very good. Welcome, counsel. Mr. Welpel, please.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal if necessary.
That's fine.
Thank you, and may it please the court. In this case, the state brought defendant to trial, alleging that his blood alcohol content was over 4 times the legal limit, when it turned out that was not defendant's blood. The state did not realize this until midway through the trial due to the state's own inexcusable neglect to review the blood vials prior to the trial. Had they reviewed the vials, it would have become immediately apparent that this could not have been defendant's blood. The collection date on the vials was 7 months prior to the accident and the blood draw in this case. Additionally, the patient number on the vials did not match defendant's patient number in his medical records. While the state always has a duty to review its evidence to ensure it is accurate, in this case they had an extra reason to second guess, which was the fact that the BAC level of 0.376 is normally such that a person would be unconscious, and yet none of the officers who interacted with defendant at the scene in this case even suspected he was intoxicated. Posed with this revelation, defense counsel invoked due process and double jeopardy and moved for the only remedy he felt was appropriate in this circumstance, which was dismissal of the indictment with prejudice, barring further prosecution. Defense counsel did not ask for just a do-over, for a retrial. The court instead granted dismissal without prejudice and held that retrial would be permitted, referring specifically to two subsections of 2C19D. Under subsection D1, the court found that defendant's motion to dismiss constituted consent for a mistrial. And under subsection D3, the court found a manifest necessity to declare the mistrial due to the prejudice to the defendant. And indeed, there was prejudice to the defendant. Both counsel, in opening statements, had stated that defendant's blood was over the legal limit. Additionally, a witness had testified that she had been with defendant prior to the accident and he had been drinking. Even assuming that the court was correct, that this prejudice was not curable with a corrective instruction, it was the state's inexcusable neglect that caused this prejudice. And State v. Farmer is clear that when it is the state's inexcusable neglect that creates the need for the mistrial, double jeopardy bars retrial. Therefore, the court's assessment under D3 was incorrect. Turning to the court's assessment under D1, first of all, the court did not rely on defendant's motion. The court, during oral argument on February 21st, made clear it felt obliged to declare a mistrial due to the prejudice to the defendant, independent of defendant's motion. And secondly, defendant's motion in this case, because it was specifically for dismissal with prejudice, sought a remedy that did not contemplate retrial. And therefore, defendant preserved his double jeopardy argument. The court should hold that in this case, under these facts, when the state's inexcusable neglect to review its blood evidence led it to bring defendant to trial with the wrong blood evidence, and that inexcusable neglect caused the need for this trial, that retrial is barred by double jeopardy. I'd like to structure my argument in 4 points. One, I'd like to address the error briefly. Two, I'd like to argue why Oregon v. Kennedy does not apply in this case, because defendant's sole remedy sought was dismissal with prejudice. Third, if Oregon v. Kennedy does not apply, then under Farmer, retrial is barred because it was the state's own inexcusable neglect that created the need for the mistrial. And fourth, if this court finds Oregon v. Kennedy would apply, We ask this court to depart from Oregon v. Kennedy under our state constitutional double jeopardy protection, following the example of seven other state Supreme Courts and the venerated history of double jeopardy protections in our state's history and common law. As I begin my first point, I invite the court's questions.
Because we don't have the trial record, could you tell us what the jury heard with respect to the BAC level?
Yes, Your Honor, and this court does have the trial record. I unfortunately, because I was an appellate counsel, I did not participate in crafting the record before the appellate division. After I initially submitted my supplemental brief, I did submit to this court the two trial transcripts.
Tell us what's in evidence with respect to the BAC level and argument to the jury in openings.
So with respect to the BAC level, there was no evidence presented. There was only reference to it in openings. The state opened saying that before Mr. Zadroga got in his car, there will be evidence there was alcohol involved. He was at two different bars in Hoboken for at least 3 hours drinking alcoholic beverages, and he was above the legal limit.
Let me zone in on what I was most focused on. Did the jury hear during openings that it was 0.376?
Yes. The state did not state that in opening. Defense counsel did, presumably to soften the blow. It's very common that defense counsel will, even if the state doesn't, highlight the most prejudicial evidence it anticipates so that the jury is not later surprised. So that's on the July 10th transcript, both that's pages 35 and 28, and then defense references the BAC on page 55. And then during the July 11th transcript, that's the testimony of Evadne Figueroa, and throughout her entire testimony, from pages 9 through pages 49, she does testify that she was with defendant and he was drinking. This error is the state's error and the state's error alone. The state had the vials in their possession, and the vials were the only evidence that conclusively indicated this was not defendant's blood. When Detective Bellini first went to retrieve the vials from the hospital, obviously the hospital made a mistake, but if the detective had just looked down at the vials, he would have seen the collection date was April from 2017, not November when the accident occurred.
Has any other case read Farmer to create a bright line rule that there can be no retrial where the necessity for the mistrial was caused by the state's bad faith or inexcusable neglect?
So in my reply to the amicus, I did set forth my argument for why Farmer should be interpreted to be a bright line rule. I don't know of a case saying the language bright line rule. I also don't know of a single case where the court found inexcusable neglect by the state and held that retrial was permitted. And that's not just New Jersey, that's including including federal jurisprudence as well, looking at the Fourth Circuit in Schaefer, where there was the state's theory at trial had to do with defendant committed arson because of a financial problem, and during trial, through a defense subpoena, it was revealed that whereas the state thought he was in financial jeopardy, he actually wasn't. And the state had his financial records in evidence, but didn't realize it. And Schaefer distinguished between excusable and inexcusable negligence is the word they used there, and held that retrial was prohibited because of the inexcusable negligence. So while I don't know of any case referring to it specifically as a bright line rule, I don't know a case permitting retrial where they found such a finding. And even if it's only one factor and not a bright line rule, I do believe under these circumstances, we would still win under Farmer. A few other things with respect to the blood evidence and the court's finding before I turn to why we should be governed by Farmer. So the court found both inexcusable neglect and bad faith. We're primarily relying on inexcusable neglect. And the court had several bases for this findings, including that the warrant commanded the state to obtain defendant's blood, not some other person's blood, which required a duty ab initio to verify that the blood it received from the hospital was defendant's blood, which Detective Bellini would have been alerted to the error had he just looked at the collection date on the vials. We acknowledged there was no name on the vials. There was a collection date. And it wasn't even close. It wasn't like a few days off. It was 7 months off.
And there was no name, and as I understand it, the hospital knew it was supposed to get the blood sample of your client.
Yes.
And this is the vial. These are the vials that it handed to the detective, right?
Yes. And there are a lot of circumstances under which other actors' errors can impact the state's evidence at trial, but it does not absolve the state of its duty to verify its evidence.
I'm not suggesting that, but there's no question here that there was no intentional, there's no allegation here of any kind of intentional switching of blood samples.
Absolutely.
You're saying the mistake was not to essentially check what the hospital was representing that it was doing by looking at that date.
Yes.
Is there, looking at that more broadly, is there any evidence of intent on the part of the state to subvert the double jeopardy clause in this case?
We are not alleging intentional misconduct of the Kennedy variety. We acknowledge that if this court holds Kennedy applies and does not depart from Kennedy, we would not prevail. But notwithstanding the fact that the state did what it was required to do under Rule of Professional Conduct 3.8 by disclosing this as soon as it revealed it, we do believe that the court's finding below that the state committed inexcusable neglect by not reviewing the evidence was correct, and that should bar retrial. Turning to why Kennedy should not apply, so this court should not apply Kennedy for three reasons. First, defendant moved for dismissal with prejudice, arguing that further prosecution should be barred. Second, Kennedy applies only where the remedy sought by defendant contemplates a new trial, so either an ordinary motion to dismiss the indictment without prejudice or a motion for a mistrial. And third, the trial court made clear in this case during the February 21st transcript that the court's decision to order a mistrial was independent of any motion by defendant. So first, looking at the language of Oregon v. Kennedy and Dinitz, which Kennedy builds on, Dinitz specifically uses the language when the mistrial has been declared at the defendant's request, or, quote, a motion by the defendant for a mistrial. Kennedy uses the same language, quote, a mistrial declared at the behest of the defendant. And then the other case, referring to motions to dismiss the indictment, that's Lee, and that refers to a motion to dismiss without prejudice. And in Lee, I actually think Lee is a good case to look at, because unlike here, in Lee, first of all, it only dealt with a facial deficiency of the indictment where the indictment didn't allege the requisite mens rea. It was apparent by immediately glancing at it, and defendant knew about it and didn't raise it until after the state had opened. And so under that so there were several reasons why double jeopardy didn't bar retrial in that circumstance. One, that the remedy sought was clearly only a regular dismissal, not dismissal with prejudice. And two, the defense counsel was partially responsible for the position that the court was in because it had waited to file that motion. So what both of those motions have in common is they contemplate retrial. Here, defense counsel specifically sought preclusion of further prosecution. During the oral argument on July 15th, the defense counsel said the case was fatally flawed, in part arguing that the Hudson County Prosecutor's Office detective's report, Detective Bassone, who wrote a fatal collision report and arrived at a conclusion that this accident would not have occurred but for defendant's reckless conduct, relied on the BAC in that finding. The defense counsel said, well, what is he going to do now? He's going to rewrite the same report but just take out the blood alcohol content? And the point is not whether or not defendant was correct about that argument under due process. The point is he was invoking due process to say that the trial cannot proceed, the prosecution cannot proceed. And then the court, instead of asking defense counsel, well, if I can't grant you dismissal with prejudice, what do you want? Do you want dismissal without prejudice? Do you want me to craft a curative instruction? The court just ruled, I'm granting dismissal without prejudice, and retrials permitted under D1 and D3.
And counsel at that point did not stand up and say, Judge, that wasn't on our application. I object to this. We insist that only be a dismissal with prejudice.
That is correct, Your Honor. Defense counsel did not object. I would characterize it as defense counsel did not interrupt the court's ruling. At that point, the court is reading its ruling. The court has ruled. The court has come to a decision. and is reciting its oral opinion. In my experience, courts find it quite rude if you interrupt them in the middle of the ruling. And it was...
Do that after, when they finish reciting their ruling.
Well, the court had ruled at that point, and I think defense counsel believed I made my double jeopardy argument. I mean, defense counsel, in addition to the due process I argued before, defense counsel specifically said, what is my client supposed to do? He's already spent $100,000 on his defense. Is his family supposed to take out another loan for $100,000? So he's raised this double jeopardy concern. He probably believed he had preserved that argument. The judge had ruled. He thought the judge was wrong. He filed a motion for reconsideration. In Downham, and I quoted this from the Fourth Circuit case, SEAYC, says, we resolve any doubt in favor of the liberty of the citizen rather than exercise what would be an unlimited, uncertain, and arbitrary judicial discretion.
In the context of a Brady violation, this court requires that the prosecutorial misconduct be willful and outrageous in order to bar a retrial. Why should something similar not apply here?
So Brady and double jeopardy are two different interests. Brady is with respect to whether defendant can get a fair trial, whether he was deprived of a fair trial, and whether he could get a fair trial, versus due process protects the defendant against multiple prosecutions, subjecting him to the anxiety, the expense, and the ordeal, when it would be grossly unfair. That's the language under Green and Arizona v. Washington. And we submit, Farmer captures when it would be grossly unfair, and it would be grossly unfair when the state's inexcusable neglect prevented defendant from being able to have a fair trial in that instance.
But the trial court here did hold specifically that it would not be grossly unfair because defendant had not been, and I think this is a direct quotation, subjected to the quantum of oppression, harassment, or egregious deprivation necessary to warrant a dismissal with prejudice of the remaining two counts that had nothing to do with the intoxication. Given that the standard of review is very deferential to a trial court's decision on whether or not to grant a mistrial, why do we not have to defer to that finding that the defendant was not subjected to this quantum of oppression, harassment, or egregious deprivation?
Your Honor, the court did find that. I'm not asking this court to overturn that finding. That finding was under the standard of fundamental fairness, operating as a backstop to double jeopardy. If you look at, so Your Honor's quoting from the opinion on defendant's motion for reconsideration, and if you look at the structure of that opinion, the court first addresses double jeopardy, first addresses due process, and then starts to address double jeopardy, but then doesn't actually issue any holding on double jeopardy. The court then turns to the fundamental fairness factors, and those factors that Your Honor was quoting are factors that our courts have applied even when double jeopardy itself doesn't bar retrial, when fundamental fairness might. And so while they are relevant to a fundamental fairness inquiry, they're not relevant to a double jeopardy inquiry.
But you were just citing something very similar, maybe not those exact same words, but you were just citing something very similar to explain why the double jeopardy rule precludes retrial, even of the counts that were not related to intoxication.
Yes, Your Honor. What I was quoting is from Arizona v. Washington and Green, which are the principles behind the double jeopardy rule, but the rule itself doesn't speak to evaluating those factors as we articulate the rule should be understood from Farmer. I'm not aware of any court evaluating how long the defendant has been subject to prosecution under double jeopardy or whether or not defendant was in custody or not in custody or the strength of the rest of the state's evidence. As far as I'm aware, those are not material to the court's consideration of double jeopardy. My final point on why Farmer should apply is if we look at the court's colloquy during the February 21st transcript, pages 23 and 25, the court says, starting on 23, quote, I think at that point, in a case like this, it was incumbent on me to declare a mistrial regardless of defense motion. That's my view. Doesn't Farmer almost mandate me declaring a mistrial in a case like this? I think it does anyway. Once the jury heard about the high blood alcohol and alcoholic consumption before a fatal crash, I don't think a jury instruction would have erased from their mind in a case like that. And so To Justice Wiener Apter's question, do we defer? I think we defer to the court's finding here. I do think that is the standard. And the court is basically saying, I would have had to grant a mistrial anyway because the defendant couldn't have had a fair trial at that point. And then we look to, so therefore defendant's motion was immaterial. And then we look to what caused the mistrial. And it was the state's error, not defendant's error. This isn't like in Dinitz, where in Dinitz, it was the defense counsel's prejudicial and inappropriate comments in opening that prejudiced the trial and created the need. Additionally, in Dinitz, unlike in this case, the court's action that spurred consideration of a mistrial was after counsel's inappropriate comments. The court excluded first counsel, trial counsel, from the courtroom. Defendant had two other counsel. And the court gave defendant three options. You can proceed with one of your other two counsel. You can seek a stay to appeal my ruling excluding your first counsel, or you can have a mistrial. And defense counsel, specifically in that case, opted for the mistrial. Here, once the court found that dismissal with prejudice was not appropriate, the court did not give defense counsel any options, did not explore any other options.
What other options were there?
Well, I think, like I said, I think that in we do need to defer, or at least the standard in this court's jurisprudence is to defer to findings of the court regarding a mistrial. But if that's the case, then we also have to defer to the court's finding that it was not relying on defendant's motion. And if it wasn't relying on defendant's motion, then we're in Farmer territory and not in Kennedy territory.
Is that correct analytically, that what the counsel said was immaterial? Supposing a counsel in another case stands up and says, Your Honor, this is such an egregious error that we have to have a mistrial here. And I'm not concerned about double jeopardy principles. We must stop this prosecution. And the judge then makes the comment that this trial judge did and said, well, I would have done that on my own. Do you ignore what counsel said?
No, Your Honor. I think that it does matter what counsel's asking for. So I'm not relying solely on the fact that the court said it would have had to do this anyway. I'm relying on that in combination with the fact that the sole remedy sought by defendant was termination of the proceeding entirely. I think any time defense counsel says, retrial is okay, like I just want a regular mistrial, then double jeopardy doesn't come into play.
No, but my point is it's not immaterial in that you ignore it. You may give it less weight, but it is a factor to be considered.
Yes, Your Honor. But I think And I believe that the way you consider it is in what the remedy specifically sought was. I did direct this court's attention to a New York State Supreme Court of Appeals case, Davis v. Brown, which was a similar scenario where a defendant did seek a dismissal of the indictment with prejudice. And the court there held that specifically once the Court of Appeals held that once the trial court deemed it not the right remedy to grant dismissal with prejudice, that it should have given the trial counsel the opportunity to say, okay, well, do you want dismissal without prejudice? Do you want a curative instruction? And didn't explore that at all, and therefore double jeopardy was preserved in that case. So I believe we did already discuss why I believe double jeopardy bars retrial under Farmer. Just in terms of looking at why focus on the state's good faith or bad faith conduct or inexcusable neglect or excusable neglect matters, looking at the pair of cases, Loyal and Hilton. Loyal is this court's case where they both involved a need for a mistrial, where it was the conflict between defense counsel who had represented a key state's witness previously. In Loyal, this court found retrial is not prohibited because state didn't know, had no reason to know. There was no bad faith or negligence by the state. In Hilton, that's a Nevada Supreme Court case, defense counsel had raised this with the state ahead of time before trial, and the court said retrial is prohibited because the state was inexcusably negligent in failing to address it before it allowed jeopardy to attach. So it is the case that across states, even in the federal jurisprudence, whether it is the defendant's fault or the state's fault, and if it's the state's fault, if that caused the mistrial, is a key factor. Unless the court has any questions about why Kennedy should not apply or why we went under Farmer, I'll turn to why this court should depart from Kennedy if it finds Kennedy does apply.
May I ask you a question with respect to that? In the jurisdictions that have a broader standard than Kennedy, do any of them not consider the prosecutor's intent?
I think that the prosecutor's intent is always relevant. The courts set a different threshold for what level of intent is required. So, for example, in New Mexico, the prosecutor has to act in willful disregard of the potential mistrial or reversal. In Oregon, the official has to know the conduct is improper. In Hawaii, there's one framing where they look at intentional misconduct, and another framing they just ask whether, they just use the word egregious, and they just say, is the prosecutor's conduct so egregious that from an objective standpoint, it clearly denied defendant his or her right to a fair trial? And then what I cite as perhaps the most relevant to this court's jurisprudence of inexcusable neglect is the Johnson standard from Pennsylvania, which uses a standard of recklessness. But what recklessness, the disregard, the willful or the knowing disregard of that recklessness is in failing to prepare for trial, right? I know I didn't double check the blood evidence. Not that I know the blood evidence is wrong. I know I didn't double check it. And that's the willful disregard as Pennsylvania interprets recklessness. The facts of Johnson are somewhat analogous to the situation here. In Johnson, the state proceeded to trial on the theory that there was one baseball cap that had both the victim's blood and defendant's blood. But it turned out there were two different baseball caps. And there were two errors that led the state not to realize this before trial. One was a police officer's error in not sufficiently documenting the second baseball cap, similar to the officer's error here and not looking at the vials and seeing that the number, the collection date was wrong. And the second was in the prosecutor's error in not comparing the property evidence receipt numbers between the two. And the court found in that case that there was prosecutor had inexcusably, recklessly failed to prepare for trial and that double jeopardy precluded retrial. So I do suggest this court could adopt Johnson, but this court wouldn't even need to adopt one of the other specific standards. This court could just return to Napo, which was a law division case, which was a gloss on Farmer. And the way Napo understood Farmer was, one, when a mistrial results from good faith prosecutorial error and is required as a matter of manifest necessity, or is granted at defendant's request, there is no bar to retrial. But two, when the circumstances bespeak bad faith, inexcusable neglect, or oppressive conduct on the part of the state, the termination is final. Obviously, our courts have recognized since Kennedy was decided that under federal law, Napo is no longer good law. However, this court could hold that Napo is the correct standard. And speaking specifically to why this court can, and again, I don't think we need to reach Kennedy. I think this can be decided under Farmer. But if this court believes we need to reach Kennedy, I think if we look at the problems with Kennedy and then our court's long history of honoring double jeopardy protections, we can depart from Kennedy. So with respect to that second point, this court in 1833 said that double jeopardy is so deeply rooted in our common law that even if we didn't have a constitutional protection, we would still apply double jeopardy protections. If we look at the 1844 Constitutional Convention, Chief Justice Hornblower expressed the same belief. He thought the proposed double jeopardy clause wasn't even necessary. And indeed, it's so deeply rooted that we protected double jeopardy in 1833, even though the federal Supreme Court did not hold that it was incorporated, the Fifth Amendment was incorporated against the states until Benton, and I believe it was 69. And even though today we apply a much greater protection under the Article 1, Paragraph 7, search and seizure, we did not apply the exclusionary rule until after Matt v. Ohio. And we were applying double jeopardy long before that. So I think it is very deeply rooted in the state's tradition.
And therefore, greater protections under our state constitution?
Yes.
But in general, we've been consistent on double jeopardy with the federal constitution.
So in many cases, this court has continued to say that our protection is coextensive. I'm just saying that doesn't, the fact that the cases this court has been confronted with heretofore doesn't bind this court. So obviously, constitutional law and common law are a matter of receiving cases with different facts, looking at the principles, and arriving at a conclusion of law that upholds those principles.
But there are a number of constitutional provisions which have deep roots in the state's history, as to which the constitutional protection under the state constitution is coextensive with the federal protection. Nothing contradictory about that.
That's correct. That's correct. And therefore, I think the deciding factor should be the problems with Kennedy itself. So first, Kennedy does not fulfill the core promise of the double jeopardy protection. Kennedy focuses only on one part of double jeopardy protection, which is defendants' right to proceed with a particular jury. However, as these other seven courts have recognized, and even Justice Stevens in the concurrence in Kennedy, that sometimes egregious prosecutorial misconduct has rendered unmeaningful defendants' choice to continue or abort the proceeding. Kennedy doesn't at all speak to the other protection of double jeopardy, which is protect defendant against repeated harassment of repeated attempts by the state to convict when it would be grossly unfair. And double jeopardy is primarily about protecting the defendant, not punishing the prosecutor. So by focusing specifically on the highest level of intent possible, specific intent to intentionally goad defendant into a mistrial, it's not focusing on that protection to defendant. And it's not even internally consistent. If a prosecutor's misconduct at trial were with the intent to secure a conviction unfairly by perhaps intentionally departing from a judge's in limine ruling regarding evidence, but his intent was not to cause a mistrial, under Kennedy, double jeopardy would not bar retrial. And so I think it's even internally inconsistent. Now,
but that's not the situation here.
That's correct.
We don't have those types of circumstances. This is a different setting. There's no evidence whatsoever that there was any intent on the part of the state to bring about a mistrial.
That is correct. We are not alleging that. We are alleging that the court's finding below of inexcusable neglect was correct under these facts.
Other than the finding of inexcusable neglect, do any of the other Smith factors apply in terms of manifest necessity?
So the way I read Smith is sort of drawing on the fundamental fairness factors, and I think that if this court holds that Farmer is applicable and not Kennedy, then the inexcusable neglect of the state in and of itself, because it wasn't just inexcusable neglect in failing to adequately prepare a specific witness. So the witness maybe says something that they shouldn't have, that normally we can cure with a curative instruction. This was so fundamental to the heart of the state's case and so prejudicial to the defendant that it couldn't have been cured. And so I think even though Smith does mention those five factors, I think this factor outweighs and carries the day with respect to any of the others.
But in terms of, you said that you don't have cases that have previously held that is a bright line rule, but there are also no cases holding the other way, that there has been inexcusable neglect, but there can be a retrial, and you specifically mentioned a Fourth Circuit case, and that's Schaefer?
Yes, that's in my reply to the AG's brief. Okay. So, unless the court has further questions, I'd just like to briefly conclude.
One question with respect to prejudice. If your argument does not prevail and defendant is directed to undergo a second trial, what is the prejudice that he suffers in this case?
So if Your Honor's question is directed to the prejudice in terms of the ability to have a fair trial moving forward, I believe that's addressed by the due process concerns that the appellate division answers. So the appellate division decided that because of the due process Youngblood violation, the only way a fair trial could be had would be to bar any evidence of intoxication whatsoever.
Is there prejudice beyond that?
The prejudice beyond that is the prejudice that every defendant suffers with a second trial. And I don't think, obviously, defense counsel did raise at the initial motion to dismiss with prejudice the specific prejudice to this defendant regarding the amount spent. I don't think that carries the day, right? We're not going to give greater double jeopardy protections to defendants who spend more or who have a, you know, less to those who have a public defender. But from that same logic, I don't think we answer a double jeopardy question by looking at the prejudice to the specific defendant versus, I mean, double jeopardy is usually, it's an on or off switch. We believe that because the reason for the mistrial here was the state's inexcusable neglect, that retrial is barred here.
I thought there was some evidence of intoxication, observation evidence by a police officer who appeared at the scene, odor of alcohol.
No, there were two officers who testified at trial who, those were officers Tulo and Minchiello, and both of which said they did not smell alcohol on defendant and he had no indicia of being under the influence. Not at trial, but in the state's discovery, it was alleged that a bus driver, Mr. Rojas, said he smelled alcohol on defendant. At trial, he didn't testify to that. The state didn't ask him, and he didn't testify to that.
This was only the beginning of the trial. There was more evidence to come in, and I thought the trial court concluded that there was other evidence that could uphold or could sustain a conviction on the counts that were not dismissed.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, so was there evidence of recklessness aside from the BAC? Yes, there was the speed. And then the state alleges that defendant crossed the double yellow lines. But the double jeopardy question isn't whether or not there was other evidence that could have convicted him, whether or not defendant could have had a fair trial on
the remaining
remand. It's whether or not the state's conduct in this case and the court's
decision. No, I understand that. I'm just saying, on the remaining counts, the court clearly found that there was other evidence that had not yet been adduced to trial that could establish the remaining counts, the ones that survived, could establish guilt on those counts.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. But the court's basis for dismissing the counts that had a BAC as an element and those that did not was not double jeopardy, it was due process. The court actually, as I mentioned to Justice the court did not actually, in its written opinion on the motion for reconsideration, really spell out a double jeopardy analysis. It started with due process, discussed double jeopardy, and then jumped to fundamental fairness.
That's also probably because at trial there was not significant discussion of double jeopardy, correct? You said that defense counsel raised double jeopardy by mentioning that defendant had already spent $100,000, but didn't discuss double jeopardy case law at any length or anything like that. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. I absolutely think defense counsel should have or could have written a brief that mentioned double jeopardy, could have mentioned double jeopardy case law. The timeline of this the testimony, second day testimony, I believe I know it's the 11th. I believe that was a Thursday. Friday was the 12th. That's when the state investigated the evidence, realized it was erroneous. The brief defense counsel filed was on the 14th, and oral argument was on the 15th. So defense counsel is raising double jeopardy and due process. If the court believed, look, you haven't given me law on which to rule, then, we have an active jury, we have an active trial. The prudent course is to say, if you want me to rule on this, I'm going to give you till tomorrow to write a brief where you actually raise that. I don't think, because defense counsel could only come up with certain law in the time defense counsel had, that defense counsel should be barred from raising these additional legal areas where they were specifically raised to the court.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Necredin.
May it please the court, I believe the justices had asked Mr. Wuffle about the prejudice that would be experienced to the defendant if he had to undergo or have a second trial. And it's not hyperbole to say that going through a trial, if you're a defendant or a lawyer who cares a lot about a defendant, is one of the worst experiences in your life. You go in there every day and you wonder and you ask yourself, if you're a defendant, is this going to be the last day that I'm going to be free, or am I going to be, you know, if I'm found guilty, am I going to be handcuffed and taken to jail or prison?
Is that the sort of prejudice that Rechtschaefer and Smith discuss?
Judge, in a general sense, when various courts discuss why double jeopardy protections are important, they reference the anxiety, the stress, both personal and financial, that a defendant experiences at trial. And, you know, why do we have double jeopardy protections? Is to protect the person from undergoing that trauma and that stress. So from a general perspective, Your Honor.
So stress and expense are the indicators, as you read the case law.
No, Judge, they're just considerations that I think the court has to take into account of why we would have strong double jeopardy protections. We can't forget about the person.
I think your point actually is well put, but what would lead to never undergoing a second trial. I don't know a defendant who enjoyed a first trial and thought it was stress-free. Of course your argument is correct, but does that carry the day in terms of the legal analysis?
Sure, Judge. And then we look at the state's conduct, and if the state's conduct is such that we should bar the state from
We're just talking about prejudice. That's where this conversation began.
Your Honor's correct. That's not the foremost considerations. Piggybacking of what Mr. Wuffel stated about substituting the Johnson case for the Oregon v. Kennedy case, I think one of the positive effects, if we were to do that, if the court finds that Farmer doesn't apply, will be that the state will be more likely to examine their case, to look at their discovery at an earlier time than on the eve of trial. I sympathize with the state. You go to court every Monday and Friday, you see a prosecutor carrying a crate of 100 files, and you know, it's very hard for, as a defense counsel, to have substantive and material conversations about your case, because frequently the state doesn't have the time or the resources to examine their case. But if we adopt the Johnson case, Your Honor, it'll require them, it'll incentivize them to look at the case earlier to make sure that all the discovery that the case has, they've looked at, they've provided, they've double-checked, so that an error like the one that we have in this case doesn't occur. So in terms of adopting the Johnson case, I think that'll have the positive effect of potentially even having cases resolved earlier on in the process. I don't want to repeat what Mr. Wuffel repeated, because he would do a much better job than me. So unless there's any questions, I would submit, Your Honor, and join my colleague's argument.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rinaldi.
May it please the court. The state submits that the trial court was correct in granting the defendant's motion to dismiss the indictment in this matter, and therefore, under 2C1-9D1, the trial was properly terminated with the consent of the defendant. Petitioner's argument that he did not consent is without merit and contradicts the record below. It is clear that when he filed the motion to dismiss the indictment, his intent was to end the trial. He never objected to the trial court granting his motion, and while arguing the motion to dismiss the indictment on July 15th, while trial was still ongoing, he didn't object to the state conceding to his motion to dismiss that indictment. There was never any objection. There was never any, in fact, the court actually noted that defense counsel consented to the dismissal of the indictment at that time. So the state submits the proper review is under Kennedy in this matter, as there was a proper termination of the trial with the consent of the petitioner. This is further shown that on reconsideration, the trial court again stated there was no question that mistrial was necessary, and then proceeded to discuss the defendant's application on reconsideration, specifically as a Brady violation and fundamental fairness. Specifically, the trial court analyzed the error by the state as a Brady violation. Defense counsel had argued that by not having the defendant's blood, he was deprived of a defense at trial, and that the court found that the defendant's due process was therefore violated by the state not preserving and obtaining the blood of the defendant. The state would submit that this finding by the trial court, as upheld by the appellate division, follows the logic this court had under State v. Brown, that as there is no evidence of prosecutorial provocation or willful misconduct, therefore the state was, the trial court was correct in dismissing the first counts of the indictment, that would be the aggravated manslaughter and reckless manslaughter, without prejudice and allowing the state to proceed. And as the trial court and the appellate division upheld the dismissal of prejudice with the counts that were specifically related to the blood alcohol content of the defendant that led to the termination of the trial, it was proper. Defendant had requested dismissal in the indictment, and as the appellate division had found, that the mistake of the state, and the state accepts there was a mistake here. There was an error in the initial collection of the blood from the Jersey City Medical Center, but that was not sufficiently outrageous to prohibit future prosecution of this defendant and therefore dismiss all counts with prejudice. If this court were to determine that there was no consent by the defendant to terminate this trial, the state submits that, as Judge Ari and the trial court had found, there was a manifest necessity to declare a mistrial. It was clear, as it was discussed off the record and then placed on the record on the date of the motion on July 15th, that there was no alternative that the trial court could see going forward to somehow separate the evidence of the blood alcohol that was presented to this jury and could not agree on a curative instruction. The state was prepared to proceed with the trial at that time, as the record below shows. However, in his reconsideration, the judge further delved into the fact, as was stated by counsel, that he did not believe that he could separate out the blood alcohol, even though it had not been provided to the jury through evidence. Defense counsel had opened to that amount. I know Chief Justice had asked about factually if it had been presented during trial. At that point, the state had not actually presented any evidence of the blood alcohol content of the blood. There had been testimony on video, I believe, of the defendant drinking at a bar and testimony that he had been drinking that night prior to the collision. The trial court had found that there was, in his opinion, no alternative to go forward, and that manifest necessity was present and necessary to terminate the trial. He did an analysis under Farmer and found that in balancing, although he did find inexcusable neglect by the state, that balancing the interest of the public and societal interest in having the defendant tried, given the severity of the charges in this case, when he balanced those, felt that double jeopardy and therefore, that prohibiting the state from going forward on the first two counts, the aggravated manslaughter, reckless manslaughter, did not warrant the state being prohibited from future prosecution of those counts. As to the counts, as I had stated earlier, the trial court did find that there was a Brady violation, and under his analysis under Arizona v. Youngblood, felt the proper remedy was to prohibit the state from future prosecution of those counts relating to the alcohol, those being the various assault counts, and the appellate division upheld that finding, further ruling that the state would be prohibited any testimony of alcohol. And the state conceded to that and believed that was a fair remedy to the due process violation, that being the Brady violation, that the state would be prohibited from going forward on presenting evidence that the defendant was drinking in a bar and there was a video of him drinking in a bar, separate from his blood alcohol from the hospital. So the state understands there was a remedy here that Judge Ari had, a decision and a remedy Judge Ari had found in terms of balancing under Farmer the societal interest and the interests of the defendant. Obviously, that's always first and foremost, is protecting the defendant's interest to a fair trial. However, society also has a right to see that defendants are prosecuted and that those trials are fair and held fairly.
Are you aware of any case that has held that if the need for the mistrial was created by the state's bad faith or inexcusable neglect, double jeopardy does not bar further prosecution?
I would state that there needs to be intent, Your Honor, that there has to be some willful misconduct or intent.
But are you aware of any case that has held that? So I asked your adversary before, are you aware of any case that has created a bright line rule that if there is bad faith and inexcusable neglect, then there must never be a retrial under double jeopardy? And he said, no, but he's also not aware of any case that has ever found that there was bad faith or inexcusable neglect, but yet double jeopardy did not bar a retrial. So I'm asking you, are you aware of any case where the court has found that there was bad faith or inexcusable neglect on the part of the state, but yet a retrial would not violate double jeopardy?
Well, I would submit that under both Farmer and State v. Loyal, that under the balancing, that even if there is inexcusable neglect, or as Judge Ari found in this case, but when he did bad faith, his bad faith analysis was under, the state would submit, under his Brady analysis in terms of bad faith and due process in terms of not preserving that evidence, not as to the double jeopardy aspect in terms of the overall prosecution of the case. So I would
but
say
in
that
Farmer, there is that language that says if some unexpected, untoward, and undesigned incident or circumstance arises which does not bespeak bad faith, inexcusable neglect, or inadvertence or oppressive conduct on the part of the state. And so that's why your adversary is arguing if there is inexcusable neglect or inadvertence or oppressive conduct on the part of the state, then there cannot be a retrial. And so I'm just asking, are you aware of any case that has ever held that there, even when there was inexcusable neglect or bad faith, a retrial could proceed and would not violate double jeopardy?
I'm not aware, but I would again state that following Farmer, the state is not prohibited here from proceeding, even with the court making those findings of inexcusable neglect, because there's a balancing that needs to be conducted. And the trial court did, in fact, balance societal's interests along with the other factors under Farmer, as had been asked before, that the conduct here, there was an oppressive, intentional conduct by the state to somehow gain an advantage or somehow put the defendant at a disadvantage during trial. I would state that numerous of the times where there's mistrials by the state, the type of evidence is somewhat here. We have a situation here where the evidence actually is beneficial to the defendant, obviously. That's why the trial court had found a Brady violation. However, the trial court also analyzed the fact that there was other evidence outside of specifically his blood alcohol for the state to proceed on. Specifically here, there was evidence the defendant was driving 88 miles per hour in a 25 mile per hour zone. That came straight from the data from his vehicle. There was testimony from witnesses at trial that the defendant had passed their vehicles, weaving in and out of traffic, passing on the right-hand side immediately before the collision. There's physical evidence that the defendant's vehicle had, in fact, crossed the double yellow line when it collided head-on with the second vehicle. There's also testimony from a passenger within his vehicle who survived the crash, who was at the bar drinking beforehand and testified as to the defendant's conduct prior to the collision and how he was operating the vehicle. All this was before Judge Ari and the trial court in terms of balancing and making his decision as to whether or not the state could proceed in terms of the trial, could proceed on the remaining counts on a retrial. I don't know if that completely answers your question, but I'm just trying to fill out the state's position as to how the trial court balanced under Farmer making his decision that prejudice should not attach to the reckless manslaughter and aggravated manslaughter count.
With respect to the issue of consent,
yes.
In your brief, you focused on consent and said there was no objection and there was a motion to dismiss. You focused here today mostly on the failure to object. The motion to dismiss was with prejudice, as we know, of course.
Correct.
And the defendant did not prevail.
Correct. Yeah.
Only in part. Doesn't that take it out of the realm of consent?
The state would submit it does not. By making that motion to dismiss the indictment, It was clear that the defendant wanted the trial to come to an end, and that by he therefore waived under 2C19D1 an objection or a future contest to double jeopardy applying because he tried to terminate the trial.
The motion to dismiss with prejudice is more than that this trial end in the moment. It's that the indictment be dismissed and not be returned, not be turned back to again. End of case.
Correct. Except I would state that by making that motion to dismiss the indictment, even though he was not granted with prejudice, he had the opportunity to object while that motion was being argued on that day when the judge had ruled.
So does that mean your only strand then is the failure to object?
No, I would state that based upon the argument he made and by affirmatively making that motion to dismiss the indictment, he was looking to terminate the trial.
But why would a motion to dismiss with prejudice be consent to a retrial? It seems like it's actually the opposite in that he is moving to have this trial end and never be tried again. And you're saying by filing that motion, he was automatically consenting to be tried again.
Well, I would state his motion to dismiss the indictment, he was focusing on the fact that the indictment itself was flawed because of the evidence that was presented to the grand jury included the blood alcohol evidence, and that the with that evidence being presented before the grand jury, that the grand jury was prejudiced, or the indictment was flawed and the grand jury was prejudiced by not being able to separate out testimony that there, in fact, the defendant's, what we at the time believed was the defendant's blood had tested for 0.376.
But to move to dismiss with, as the chief noted, with prejudice means that's it. That bad indictment is gone on those charges. And I'm trying to understand at what point defendant was supposed to object when he made his argument with regard to dismissing with prejudice. He didn't win on that because the trial court ruled to dismiss without prejudice, but then filed a motion for reconsideration, once again asking the trial court to dismiss the indictment with prejudice. So I'm trying to understand at what point was why is the failure to object at some point during that sequence of events when he made the motion for a dismissal with prejudice, didn't win on that, and then filed a motion for reconsideration?
I would submit the record below shows that as the motion was being argued and as the state consented to the motion to dismiss the indictment, defense counsel, did not object once even the state had conceded the motion to dismiss the indictment.
Do you see a difference between a motion to dismiss and a motion to dismiss with prejudice? And what's the significance and impact of the distinction, if there is one?
I would state there isn't a difference in terms of during trial with that motion being filed because it's looking for a dismissal of the trial or the termination of the trial at that point.
And aren't you ignoring the last two words with prejudice?
I am not. And I'm stating that that was argued on the date of the motion to dismiss, and the defendant lost that aspect of it and did then, in fact, after the fact, file a reconsideration as to those counts. I'm not minimizing or dismissing the fact that he was seeking a motion or dismissal with prejudice of the indictment. However, I would submit that he had the opportunity once the court had ruled that the motion was going to be dismissed, and the transcript below shows that at that time, he did not only not object, the trial court had gone
right. Or ruled, right?
I'm sorry.
So you just said he had the opportunity to object after the court ruled. You're
right.
Agreeing with defense counsel that the court basically just went into its oral ruling, correct?
Correct. After the parties had argued, the trial court had went into its oral opinion, gave an opinion at that point.
So how is objecting after an oral ruling any different from filing a motion for reconsideration?
I would state that at that point, and I would submit that defense counsel could have asked for an immediate reconsideration, or as the jury had not been dismissed at that point, that he could have asked the court at that time to reconsider his decision since the court had ruled it was without prejudice. He could have asked immediately that if that is the court's position, that this would be without prejudice, which would allow the state a retrial, which is clear from the transcript as The state and the defense counsel in the court went immediately to scheduling for a retrial at that point. There's discussion as to upcoming trial dates discussed. So it was clear that the trial court had dismissed without prejudice, and it was the state's intent to represent the case, represent the indictment without the, represent the case without the incorrect blood alcohol and move forward. I would submit that defense counsel at that time could have, before the jury had not been dismissed, could have asked the court for reconsideration or more time at that point if he planned to proceed with the trial.
But you could almost always ask for reconsideration. That's not part of the construct.
Correct. Correct.
The principal bases are consent and failure to object in this case, and the motion to dismiss. I don't understand the objection part in this regard. Were you expecting counsel to stand up and say, "Judge, I objected before. I wanted this case gone for eternity," and then stand up after and say, "And I really meant it"?
That's what
a dismissal with prejudice is. I want this case gone.
Correct.
Never brought back. Would the objection have been, "And Judge, I meant what I said before"?
No, I would submit that after the trial court had ruled and ruled that it was without prejudice, he could have asked for an immediate reconsideration at that point, or moved to withdraw his motion to dismiss, if given that the court was going to do it without prejudice.
I just think practically it just doesn't make much sense. The motion is made, the motion is argued, so the parties, including defense counsel, makes all of his arguments to the judge right then and there rules, and then again, right after the judge finishes ruling from the bench, defense counsel stands up and says, "I object to your ruling."
I think he could have asked. It's the state's position that, again, defense counsel was looking to terminate the trial. And that, by making that motion, he was therefore consenting to the termination of that trial.
For all time. You're leaving out the critical language.
I was about to say the determination then after the judge had ruled that he would in fact grant the motion to dismiss the indictment, then moved on to the with or without prejudice. The fact that defendant was seeking with prejudice, again, I would state that under the rule, it really isn't a moment that he wanted the trial terminated and then could, again, as he did, file for reconsideration as to the double jeopardy aspect with prejudice, which he did do.
But if what we're talking about is consent to a retrial, how is it of no moment that he moved to have the case go away forever for there to be no retrial?
I may be saying that more a timing issue in terms of he was looking to terminate the trial mid-trial by making the motion to dismiss the indictment. Whether or not the court granted it with or without prejudice, the state would submit, again, he was looking to terminate the trial. That's why he made the motion.
Isn't your strongest argument manifest necessity warranted a mistrial? Not
if this court finds that there was not consent,
no,
yes.
I'm just saying, isn't your strong, you have two arguments.
Correct. There are two parallel arguments.
Isn't your strongest one manifest necessity required a mistrial? Forget about consent for a minute.
We have your position on consent. You're not waiving it.
Yes.
You're being gently prodded to move on to manifest necessity.
Manifest necessity, yes. Again, if this court were to find then that consent was not, the defendant did not consent to the termination of the trial, moving to manifest necessity, the trial court below was clear in their analysis that, as noted by, there was discussions off the record that which then placed back on the record by the trial court at the motion date on July 15th, that given the concurrent or the evidence that had been presented, that there was evidence the defendant had been drinking, both by witnesses, video evidence, even though the actual blood alcohol hadn't been presented yet. Defense counsel had opened to the blood alcohol amount. The state had only opened to the fact that it had been tested and he was above the legal limit. The actual number was not presented to the jury yet through the state's case. The trial court felt that there was no curative instruction to somehow separate that fact that they had been told by defense attorney what the blood alcohol amount is, been presented of evidence that he'd been drinking by multiple witnesses, and then effectively asked them to disregard that as the state proceeded with its case. as Justice Solomon had noted, effectively the case was about halfway through at that point. There had been the testimony from the collision, but none of the, if you will, technical data, crimes.
The testimony from the collision, did you say?
The testimony from the collision of the witnesses who were present at the collision had been presented. So there had been testimony from, again, the passenger in the defendant's car, one of the passengers from the vehicle that was struck, as well as the officers who were on scene, and other drivers who were out there who witnessed the defendant's operation of the motor vehicle prior to the collision. The state had not yet moved into, if you will, the crash reconstruction data from the black box from the defendant's motor vehicle, which establishes speed, or further crime scene photos to further establish, as I stated, the crash reconstruction. The state, as noted, was prepared to move forward during the trial if need be. The trial court's feelings that somehow asking this jury to disregard both the defendant's opening statements regarding the blood alcohol and the fact that he had been drinking, which was established, again, through video and witnesses who were with the defendant, there was no curative instruction that could ensure a fair trial for the defendant going forward, that there would be a taint to any verdict that was obtained based upon that evidence, even though, as the trial court did in its balancing, there was strong evidence of recklessness outside of the alcohol, did not see any type of curative instruction that could be presented. So the state...
Didn't the appellate division hold that a mistrial was necessary not to protect defendant's constitutional rights, but instead because, quote, a limiting instruction would not have sufficed to cure the massive prejudice to the state that defense counsel would surely exploit?
I would say that that would go to trial, obviously trial strategy of the defendant and proceeding with the trial, that defense counsel had the opportunity to continue to press this gaping mistake in the state's case in its initial investigation from the very beginning. That balancing, however, I would state that when looking at under the manifest necessity, that any curative instruction would obviously, there would be an issue with the state's case moving forward, but we're looking to, again, protecting the defendant's rights. And I don't think a curative instruction could have ensured would have removed any taint if there were a conviction to be obtained based upon the overall blood evidence of drinking that night by the defendant that had been presented before we even got to the actual blood alcohol toxicology test.
Is there anything else you'd like to present?
Unless Your Honors, the Justice have any further questions, the state would just submit that we would ask this court to uphold the ruling of the appellate division in terms of finding that the trial court was correct in dismissing the alcohol-related counts with prejudice, but that allow the state re-prosecution on the reckless manslaughter and aggravated manslaughter counts.
Thank you. Mr. Cooper-Dell.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I think it's important to keep in mind in this case that the guiding principle here is that generally when a criminal case is terminated mid-trial, that the expectation is that a retrial will occur, and that can occur, so long as either the defendant consents to terminating that first trial, or there's manifestness, the judge finds manifest necessity to terminate that first trial, regardless, in that case, of defendant's consent. So I have to just first say I don't agree with defendant's representation that if this court finds Farmer applicable, and assuming that it finds that the judge here abused his discretion by finding manifest necessity to dismiss this indictment, that the court would not then also need to look at Kennedy. I think the court would have to find that neither the Farmer test nor the Kennedy test were satisfied in order to reverse in this case. Whereas the state, as long as either is satisfied, as long as either this court agrees that the defendant consented or agrees that there is manifest necessity, that the double jeopardy bar will not apply. Just looking at the issue of consent, I think, again, it's important to look at what the guiding principle there is, the right that's being protected, this subset of double jeopardy rights, which double jeopardy is typically described as protecting against second prosecution after conviction, second prosecution after acquittal, or multiple punishments for the same offense. And so this sort of subsidiary right of those three core principles is that the defendant has a right to a verdict from a given jury, or maybe more accurately expressed as a right to choose whether to complete a trial with a given jury or to terminate that trial early. That's, of course, assuming the judge, that right can be subordinated to a finding of manifest necessity. But generally, that's the right that's being protected. So the question is not then whether the defendant is consenting to retrial. The question is whether the defendant is consenting to not get a verdict from the jury that's been impaneled. And I think here it is clear that the defendant did consent and want that. And the fact, I mean, a couple things to say about the sort of lack of objection. Well, first, he moved to this, what his notice of motion and proposed order said were simply dismiss the indictment. And I understand that in his papers and in oral argument, he was asking for dismissal of the indictment with prejudice. I'm not saying he wasn't, but I think that's not unusual to ask for one level of relief with the expectation that maybe some lesser level of relief will be granted. I think it's well known that a dismissal of the indictment with prejudice
and is understanding you correctly to be saying that the fact that the attorney, an attorney, asks for dismissal with prejudice, those last two words have no meaning in the analysis of consent?
Not at all, Your Honor. I'm saying that...
Because you just said all he wanted was for this jury that was impaneled not to return a verdict.
Well, yes, that's the key question, is whether he wanted for this jury to not return a verdict. So that is true.
But he wanted more, and as to the more, you're saying, don't worry about it in terms of your analysis of consent. Our focus is simply on what this impaneled jury might or might not do.
What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that his priority then was terminating that prosecution, and that he would like dismissal with prejudice, but he certainly at no point represented that he exclusively wanted dismissal with prejudice. And defendants,
why did he have to do that?
Well, in order to make it clear that when the judge started saying, I'm going to find dismissal of the indictment warranted, but not with prejudice, that the trial could then be continued, because that would be the alternative. If he wants, the question is whether the jury is going to continue at that point. If all he wants is a dismissal with prejudice, the alternative, if that's not granted, is to continue with the jury.
So since we're focused on counsel's intent here, mm-hmm. With respect to consent, what does it mean when a lawyer stands up and says, I move to dismiss with prejudice?
I understand that it means that they are asking for that relief. I think that defendant is trying to compare this case to the New York case Davis. If you look at Davis, what really sets Davis apart, I think Davis is very instructive for this situation. Because what happened in Davis was defense counsel moved to dismiss with prejudice. The trial judge responded by saying, I'm going to grant dismissal. I'm going to reserve on a decision whether the dismissal of the indictment will be with prejudice or without. And defense counsel immediately said, wait a minute, Your Honor. I want to modify my prior representation. I only want dismissal with prejudice. If you're not going to grant that, I want to continue with and not just there, but later too.
You're quite correct that the Davis case shows more could be done. But how does that undo the fact that when an attorney stands up and says, Your Honor, I seek a dismissal with prejudice, that's exactly what they mean?
Well, I think it doesn't undo. I think there are a couple of responses to that. I mean, first, that's still consent to terminate that trial, to not get a verdict from that jury, which is what's being considered here. So if the alternative is, I want to proceed with trial, it should be made clear up front so the judge can account for that. And if not, there's basically a very brief window. I mean, well, first of all, I do need to point out that when that motion was argued, the state was in fact making reference to the fact that the defendant was consenting to terminate the trial and the double jeopardy standard. And the state argued, even though this was the defendant's motion, the state argued first. So the defense counsel then had a chance to respond to it and did not say anything about it. The judge issued an oral ruling, but of course had not yet. I understand that generally, once a judge rules from the bench, that's not usually a time when lawyers would be jumping up to objecting. That might typically be considered rude. But this is a situation where defense counsel knew that the judge, based upon that ruling, would imminently then release that jury. So there was a very narrow window of time where if he wanted a verdict from that jury, and that's the question, is whether he wanted a verdict from that jury or whether he was consenting to not get a final verdict, a judgment out of this trial, that was the time when it had to be raised, because
Your basic argument is, for our purposes, the issue of consent only relates to whether he consented to have that particular jury not render its verdict.
Yes.
Whether he asked for prejudice, without prejudice, whatever. Once he says, I'm okay with that particular jury not hearing this case and deciding it to verdict, double jeopardy is off the table.
Yes, Your Honor. And that's not to say that he couldn't have said, I want dismissal with prejudice, but if you deny dismissal with prejudice, I want to continue with that jury. I think a defendant could absolutely make that representation.
We understand. We understand your view on this issue. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do just want to make sure, I think that the failure to object should not be viewed simply as a technicality, but also as being reflective of defendant's actual position at that time. That even though he did move for reconsideration, he didn't say, Judge, I want you to reconsider. I really did want to continue with that jury. He said, I wanted you to dismiss with prejudice based on due process violations. And again, this idea of the judge really, upon denying that motion, should have brought the jury back in and continued the trial wasn't even suggested by defendant until supplemental briefing before the appellate division.
But so there were three options here. There were three options. So there was a denial of the mistrial, and therefore we continue with this jury. There was a with prejudice, and there was a without prejudice. And it seems that he consistently was seeking the with prejudice.
I'm not rejecting
both of those other options. So you're suggesting he should have maintained his position by saying, but if I don't get with prejudice, let's continue with this jury?
I'm not saying that he wasn't asking for dismissal without prejudice, but I am saying that at no time before the trial court or even an initial briefing before the appellate division did he say that he wanted to continue. But he said that one of those other options was preferable. He was saying, continue to say, I'd like dismissal with prejudice, but that when the alternative is to continue with the jury, when what he's saying now is that what the judge should have done is continued with that jury, that needed to be raised before the jury was dismissed.
Why don't we turn to manifest necessity?
Yes, Your Honor. So manifest necessity, as was covered, a parallel basis for permitting an early termination of a trial without raising a double jeopardy bar. The judge did properly find in this case, and what he was finding, it was based on, well, of course, on defense motion, but the idea there was that the grand jury indictment in this case was palpably defective based on the fact that the state presented to it. So I understand, Justice Wiener, after you're asking about the appellate division's ruling on manifest necessity, I do understand that the appellate division wrote about prejudice to the state resulting in manifest necessity. With all due respect to the appellate division, I think that the discretion in determining manifest necessity is granted to the trial judge, and I would ask that this court's focus here remain on the trial judge's findings, which were all about the defects in the indictment and the prejudice that would be caused to defendant by being prosecuted on an indictment that was based on materially false evidence that had been presented to it.
You heard me ask your colleagues already, but do you know of any case that has ever held that if the need for the mistrial is created by the state's bad faith or inexcusable neglect, double jeopardy does not bar further prosecution?
Your Honor, I don't know a case that explicitly says that, but I think there's an explanation there in that the most often when manifest necessity comes up, well, most often when it comes up is when you have a hung jury. Aside from that, when we're getting into appellate rulings on this issue, most often when that comes up, of course, is when it's being considered in the context not of prejudice to the defendant, but of prejudice to the state or of some sort of more neutral reason that makes the trial impossible to continue. And so I think those discussions of bad faith and inexcusable neglect, absolutely that is something that can be considered when the trial judge in exercising her discretion in finding whether there's manifest necessity to terminate a trial. But I think that the where it comes up is in these situations where there's something that's happened that's more directly related by the state to what's causing the result. So either bad faith most often comes up in the context of, is the state trying to goad the defendant into a mistrial or even goad the judge into granting them? Is the state trying to tee it up for a mistrial because the case is going very badly for the state and the state anticipates an acquittal and wants to basically avoid the double jeopardy bar that would come up with an acquittal by doing something to trigger a mistrial? And I think where we see inexcusable neglect come up most often is in cases most frequently having to do with witnesses. So when they get there and they're ready for the trial and the state says, our star witness is unavailable and we don't know where they are, and they start asking, well, had you looked into this before? Had you tried to prepare this witness? Did you know whether they were going to be unavailable or not? And then they're looking at inexcusable neglect. So I think it often is more things that tie in more directly to, did the prosecutor do something that's really directly bringing about this need for a mistrial, the fact that the trial can't go forward, instead of more remote things that occur during, during pretrial proceedings, during the investigation. So the short answer is I don't know a case where there has been bad faith or inexcusable neglect found, but I don't think that means that the judge's manifest necessity finding in this case was not a proper exercise of his discretion.
But you acknowledge that language does exist in Farmer that says if some unexpected, untoward, and undesired incident arises which does not bespeak bad faith, inexcusable neglect, or inadvertence, goes on to say, you know, judge can consider. So that's why I think defendant is pointing out there is this language in Farmer. They're arguing that it creates a bright line rule. You, of course, oppose that, but you're not aware of any case that has ever taken that language out.
No, I don't think there's any, no, I don't think so. I mean, I would just stress that in Farmer, that quotation falls in sort of several pages of analysis of different reasons why there is manifest necessity and why a mistrial may need to be granted without a double jeopardy bar. I don't know that, I certainly recognize that quotation is, that excerpt is sometimes quoted by courts. Again, we agree that that's a part of a proper totality of the circumstances test. I don't think it's the end-all be-all of the manifest necessity determination. I do want to point quickly to the discussion of by the defendant of a quotation from Green about sort of the purpose of double jeopardy to prevent results that are grossly unfair. Now, Green, of course, was a case from the United States Supreme Court, and in fact, the United States Supreme Court actually subsequently walked back from that section and the reasoning of Green a little bit, saying, looking at, I don't think it was the grossly unfair quotation, but looking at the quotation from Green about how the state should not be allowed to make repeated attempts to convict an individual for an alleged offense, therefore by subjecting him to embarrassment, expense, and ordeal, and compelling him to live in a continuing state of anxiety. And the United States Supreme Court in United States v. Scott, 437 U.S. 82, and this is at 95 and 96, said, upon fuller consideration, we're now of the view that this language from Green, while entirely appropriate in the circumstances of that opinion, is not a principle which can be expanded to include situations in which the defendant's responsible for the second prosecution. What they mean by that is that the defendant there moved to terminate the trial based on pre-indictment delays. So I know that the facts are not there not entirely on all fours, but they're not saying this was defense counsel who done and something prejudicial. They mean that by saying that defendant had moved to end this prosecution midway through, and that they're not finding then that this section of Green should apply to always mean that it's that there's always a double jeopardy bar in the sorts of circumstances. I will quickly touch getting on to this sort of question of, I think the defendant's request for this court to broaden the Kennedy standard or broaden and either adopt the Johnson rule or something else gets into a few issues. And I think first, a really key one, is that those cases, and other courts have found this, that those cases are starting to kind of conflate due process protections and double jeopardy protections, and that they're not the same, that this the state has many due process protections. There's, of course, a huge body of case law on due process and an established standard for when dismissal with prejudice is an appropriate response to due process violations. And as Justice Wainwright pointed out, that was discussed by this court in State v. Brown. The Appellate Division has also, in several published cases, talked about, well, the Appellate Division has talked about how dismissal with prejudice for due process usually is only appropriate when there's basically no possibility of having a fair trial again, whereas defendant in this case has conceded there's no due process obstacle that he could have a fair trial if he's re-prosecuted in this case. So the state has many due process protections which adequately protect, which I'd say actually very well protect defendant's rights in these cases. And the proposal to instead apply the double jeopardy bar to due process violations is an attempt to essentially circumvent these established standards and create a standard that's easier for defendants to meet. I think there are two problems with that idea as well. I think first, defendants' arguments kind of rest on this idea that it's inherently detrimental to defendants to be subjected to retrial, when in fact I think that very often mistrial and retrial is a concrete benefit to defendants because it saves them the time of completing that trial, and if they're convicted, going through the time and expense of appeal, and if their conviction is reversed on appeal, then they're subject to retrial then, years later, after much litigation, and if they're and much money spent, money and time spent on that. So in that sense, mistrial and retrial is beneficial to defendants in allowing them to cut that short when they say, there's a really bad problem in this case, let's fix it now instead of way down the road. The other kind of issue there is that, and this was pointed out by, well, this is sort of the same issue, but this was addressed by Farmer and also the U.S. Supreme Court in some cases where they're saying, if we make it more likely that the grant of a mistrial is going to erect a double jeopardy bar to re-prosecution, trial judges are likely to become much more reluctant to grant mistrials, and thus really forcing defendants, if defendants can't get mistrials for serious errors and quick retrials, then they're all going to be forced into this avenue of completing the trial, seeking reversal on appeal, and being subject to retrial much later, which would be a net detriment to them. And I think that all this, of course, must also, well, sorry, I should just say defendant in response to the amicus brief on that point, I think said that Johnson, perhaps some of these other states who adopted the standard, don't just apply the double jeopardy bar in mistrial context, but also for reversal on appeal. So essentially this is becoming not just a, well, this mistrial was maybe improperly granted, they should really have continued with it, so there's a double jeopardy bar, or this mistrial is necessary because of the state's misconduct. But it starts to become, if there's an error, if there's some serious error by the state during that trial, that becomes just an acquittal at that point. There can't be a retrial, and there can't be a reverse there can't be a retrial after a mistrial, and there can't be a retrial after a reversal on appeal, but that's just not automatic acquittal. And I would suggest that, while of course it's very important to protect defendants' rights, due process.
It's a little more than a serious error. I mean, we're talking about a pretty narrow class of, and listening to your discussion of how the standard would affect other cases, we're really talking here about a narrow subset of mistrial cases, aren't we? Where there's inexcusable neglect?
Yes, I believe so. I mean, yes.
Those jury issues about, you know, juror substitutions and hung juries and all those cases are not on the table here. It's really a very narrow group of cases.
That's right, Your Honor. It is a narrow case. I certainly acknowledge that, that there's very little in terms of comparable case law.
There are a lot of mistrial cases, but very few that deal with this.
That's right, Your Honor. I think one of the risks, one of the reasons this would be a risk of the type I'm describing is that a trial judge would presumably be cognizant of the fact that if they say, I'm granting a mistrial based on this conduct by the state, but I don't think it rises to the level of inexcusable neglect, they might still have an eye to worry that the appellate division could then say, Well, we think it was inexcusable neglect, and we're going to say that there's a double jeopardy bar. So I think that it would give sort of force, well, it could end up with trial judges.
Have a broader...
It would cut a broader swath, potentially, because of concern about whether this mistrial ruling, even though the trial judge anticipates there would be a retrial, could actually ultimately end up being the equivalent of an acquittal. So, for all those reasons, unless there are any other questions, Your Honors, the Attorney General would ask this court to reject defendant's arguments and affirm the orders below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome, brief rebuttal. And I, please come to the center. I wanted to start with a question, if I could, pivoting off of the Attorney General's argument. In a case like this, where a judge is concerned, you have serious charges, there's evidence of reckless conduct that results in death, it's independent of the alcohol evidence, there's a strong public interest in proceeding in a case like that to trial. Is there a way that a trial judge could navigate a path toward trial on the non-alcohol-related counts, short of continuing the original trial, getting reversed on appeal, the likely outcome, and having it returned for a retrial? Or is there simply no remedy at all?
Is Your Honor asking about whether the judge could have done anything different in the moment, a ruling on when the judge dismissed without prejudice? Is that moment in time?
Is there any way for a judge faced with these sorts of circumstances to salvage the trial?
I'm not here today saying specifically that there was any specific course of conduct the court should or could have taken.
I know you're not. You're swinging for the fences, and I respect that. I'm asking if, as you understand the law, is there a pathway for a case like this to be retried, or must it result in dismissal, end of case?
Our position is that if the reason there was no way for the court to salvage the trial at that point originated with the state's inexcusable neglect.
So just to carry that one step further, if the judge had denied your motion and continued the trial, conviction, reversal on appeal, could that case be retried at that point?
At this point in time, we are not asking this court to issue any ruling regarding how double jeopardy applies after a conviction. In Brown, this court didn't reject the idea that double jeopardy could apply after a conviction, although it did not rule in defendant's favor because there was no allegation of wrongdoing by the state in that case. I don't think the court needs to reach that question. I will say, even beyond the seven states that have departed from Kennedy, all of which do apply the same standard for a mistrial or reversal after conviction when it's prosecutorial conduct that caused the error, even beyond those seven states, the Second Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, and a number of other states not included within those seven hold that Kennedy itself should apply when reviewing a conviction after appeal and reversing.
So I know you're not asking for a ruling in this case on this. I'm asking instead, do you have a position on behalf of the public defender on this question now?
I don't have a position on behalf of the public defender. I do think it is logically consistent to apply the same rule. The way that the Second Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, I believe is the First Circuit as well, what they say is they extend Kennedy, so it's not just where the prosecutor intended to go to mistrial, it's or where the prosecutor intended to unfairly secure a conviction. I think that makes sense. I think that solves one of the inconsistencies of Kennedy. So I think it is logically consistent to apply the same or similar standard. My client is not.
You're saying they extend Kennedy to inexcusable neglect settings?
No, Your Honor. The seven states that depart from Kennedy under their state constitutional provisions, they apply generally the same standard to a mistrial motion as to reversal after a conviction. Yeah, reversal on appeal. Of the states that don't purport to depart from Kennedy, including some circuits, the Seventh Circuit, Second Circuit, First Circuit, this originates with Wallach, and Wallach is cited by Batts. I apologize, I didn't cite Wallach in the brief, but Batts, which is the California case, does draw from Wallach. which is W-A-L-L-A-C-H, which is in the California Bass case. That's the Second Circuit case. They apply Kennedy itself, slightly modified, to reversal after conviction as well, where it's if the prosecutor intended to go to mistrial or intended to secure a conviction intentionally through misconduct. And so I'm just saying it, I think logically makes sense to apply the same principle as many courts have recognized. I'm not asking for that here. My client's not asking for that. This court doesn't need to reach that question here, is all I'm saying.
Please go ahead.
The two points that I wanted to make, I will be very brief. With respect to Your Honor's, one, with respect to Your Honor's question earlier regarding prejudice to defendant on retrial, I would just direct this court to a number of cases where that's not really a consideration at all. I mean, in Love, a Third Circuit case, that which held retrial was barred. It was the judge's mother-in-law passed away, and so the judge granted a mistrial without looking at potential adjournment or looking for a reassignment. And there was not going to be any prejudice to defendant on retrial other than, you know, having to go through another trial. And that didn't carry the day. Same thing with SEAYC from the Fourth Circuit in Downham, where it was what caused the mistrial was the state's witness not being available.
So our case law does have that as a factor. And that's why I was asking, was there a circumstance like the one that you just mentioned? They lost a witness, something happened that put them in a diminished position to defend the case if it were to be retried, not just anxiety and expense.
Well, so what I didn't say earlier that I would say now is, you know, we don't know what the state's going to do with Detective Bisson's fatal collision report, which relied on alcohol in reaching the conclusion that defendant was reckless. It said, with a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, I opine that defendant's reckless conduct was a but-for cause. And so if they revise it to eliminate alcohol, well, how is defense counsel supposed to effectively cross-examine and impeach detective? Well, didn't you originally base this on alcohol without opening the door to the fact that there were witnesses who saw defendant drinking? And so defendant's ability to effectively cross-examine the state's evidence without opening the door for the state to then get around the appellate division ruling as to what due process remedy was required, I think, is an issue. And then second, just finishing on Farmer and whether there's a bright line rule. So in my reply to the amicus attorney general brief, I did the way that Farmer is applied, it does seem to be as if it were a bright line rule, even if not articulated as such. So if we look at Dunn's, Stavey Dunn's appellate division case here, the appellate division surveys numerous state and federal cases regarding specifically the unavailability of a state's witness that caused a mistrial. It said the general rule is that if the prosecutor was not in some way responsible for the witness's unavailability, then manifest necessity exists for a mistrial. And the court specifically found that distinguishable from Downham or Stanny, where the unavailability of the prosecution witness was at least in some part due to the prosecutor's neglect or lack of preparation. And I think the reason it makes sense to think of it as, if not a strict bright line rule, something akin to that, is that otherwise, you know, the state could create manifest necessity through its own inexcusable neglect and then get a do-over, get a second bite of the apple because of its own inexcusable neglect.
Except that here, the hospital made the mistake. The neglect here was that the prosecutor, the investigator, didn't realize it until they were on trial and they finally compared the numbers and the dates. In other words, and if, as I understand it, the nurse, right up till and including trial, maintained they had the right samples. She never conceded that it was their mistake, but it was, in fact, the hospital's mistake.
A few things, Your Honor. Undoubtedly, the error originated with the hospital. I don't think that excuses detective failing to look down at the vials.
I'm not saying that, but clearly he was negligent in some way. That's part of trial preparation.
And the state actually conceded below gross negligence. This is in the February 24th transcript.
Giving them the benefit of the doubt.
The state conceded gross negligence on page 35, line 21 of the February 21st transcript. Your Honor's point, just factually regarding the nurse, it wasn't the nurse who insisted it was the right blood. I think it was the director of the Director Corona or Cardona or something. But, I mean, let's all be clear. It's probably to avoid liability in this sure. case. And the court said in its mistrial ruling, I told the state I could consider ordering the hospital personnel down here. I presume I would be met with the hospital's lawyers and therefore decided not to do that.
Would barring the state's expert cure the inability to cross?
So that's not really an issue before this court. That again, I do think would go more to due process than to double jeopardy. What we appealed from the appellate division was the double jeopardy ruling. And so I do think there are other considerations regarding prejudice on retrial. That's not necessarily before this court. I would be happy to brief it if this court would like, but
Now the reason why I asked questions is because you said that's the prejudice. The defendant's inability to cross-examine state's evidence without raising alcohol.
Well, my first position is the prejudice is not a primary consideration in double jeopardy. That was my attempt to answer the chief's question. Mm-hmm. And I think my final statement is, when it's the state's inexcusable neglect that makes it impossible for the defendant to get a fair trial in that proceeding, then the state has taken away the defendant's option to go forward to that jury. And that's why this is at the heart of double jeopardy, that double jeopardy protection, and why this court should hold double jeopardy bars retrial in this case. Unless the court has any further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Welford.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel for the fine arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.